Lecture 14, Evolution and Human Nature.
Most of the aspects of personality that we've covered already have dealt with ways in which people's personalities differ from one another. As we move into talking about where personality comes from, I want us to start in this lecture by looking at features of personality that you share with virtually everybody else. As we have seen, personality reflects tendencies or regularities in people's thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, how a person generally tends to respond. And when we step back and look at human beings as a whole, we find that they all show some of the same general tendencies. There are features of personality that can be seen in just about everybody, no matter where they live or what experiences they've had. There are ways in which your personality resembles everybody else's personality. To show you what I mean, let me give you just a couple examples of human psychological universals. For example, I guarantee that you want to be accepted and approved of by at least a few other people in your life. There's no normal person anywhere in any culture who absolutely doesn't care whether anybody likes or accepts them. There's nobody who's not troubled at times by feeling ignored or disapproved of or rejected. People may differ in how concerned they are about rejection, but wanting to be accepted by at least a few people is part of human nature. And so much of what you think, feel, and do reflects this universal desire for acceptance. Here's another one. I bet that all other things being equal, you don't find that people with blemished or scarred or disfigured faces are as physically attractive as people without blemishes, scars, and disfigurement. I'm not saying that you don't like them or reject them, just that there's something about facial blemishes and scars and skin infections that make people less attractive. Now, you might be thinking, well, sure, of course, oozing sores are less attractive than clear skin. But there's not any of course to it. It wouldn't have to be that way. Why does everybody think that clearer skin is more attractive than oozing skin? One more. Imagine that you're walking into a room full of 15 strangers. And they're standing around clustered into two different groups. One group contains all people of your own ethnic group, and the other group is composed entirely of people of another ethnicity. Which group would you feel most comfortable walking up and joining? I suspect that the vast majority of you are thinking, well, I hate to admit it, but I'd feel a little more comfortable with my own group. That's a pretty universal reaction as well. I could go on, but you get the idea. There are regularities and tendencies in your emotions and behavior that can be seen in almost everybody else's personalities as well. And we need to talk about where those aspects of your personality came from. When you learned about evolution in school, you probably focused mostly on the evolution of animals' physical characteristics, like the giraffe's long neck or human beings' opposable thumbs. And you probably learned that these characteristics evolved because animals who had them survived and reproduced at a higher rate than those who didn't. There was an adaptive advantage for giraffes to have long necks because they could reach more food. And there was an adaptive advantage to having an opposable thumb to grasp things. So gradually, through the process of natural selection, animals with an adaptive characteristic had more offspring than those without the characteristic. The descendants of giraffes with longer necks survived and thus reproduced at a higher rate than those with short necks. So the giraffe gene pool became dominated by genes for long necks. You've heard that sort of thing before. Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, was all about these sorts of physical characteristics. But toward the end of the book, Darwin suggested that his ideas about natural selection could also be applied to psychological characteristics. I know that some people have a harder time seeing how psychological characteristics can evolve than seeing how physical characteristics evolve, but it's the same process. After all, the brain is a physical organ, and just like every other organ of the body, it's subject to the process of natural selection. So, if an animal's brain is designed in such a way that it leads to behavior that increases survival and reproduction, then the genes for that more adaptive brain will get passed along at a higher rate, and the behavioral tendency will become part of the species' general personality. Anything that's part of human nature, just about any characteristic that we see in every normal person, is the result of natural selection. And that means that the aspects of your own personality that you share with everybody else probably reflect evolutionary processes. When thinking about these characteristics, we have to keep in mind that the processes that produced human nature as it is today occurred over millions of years. After all, it's been well over 6 million years since the branch of the family tree that led to modern human beings split from the branch that led to modern chimpanzees and bonobos. And many of these evolutionary processes were going on long before then. What that means is that most of the processes that created human nature happened long before we became fully human, only in the last 200,000 years or so. And these processes happened in an environment that was dramatically different from the one we live in today. We're talking about a period of several million years in which our pre-human ancestors lived in small bands that wandered across the plains of Central Africa. They were hunters and gatherers and scavengers. They didn't have homes, didn't have jobs, no property except maybe a sharp rock or a stick. They didn't worry about getting an education or planning for retirement. The universal aspects of human personality evolved to meet the challenges of living in that sort of an environment. That's important because it means that our personality includes some evolved tendencies that might have worked great 500,000 years ago, but that aren't very helpful and might even be problematic in the 21st century. At the most basic level, the evolved characteristics that are relevant to understanding personality involve psychological processes that steered behavior in ways that promoted survival and reproduction during the course of evolution. So it's helpful to think about the recurring problems that our prehistoric ancestors faced that had implications for the likelihood that they would survive and reproduce. So as infants, they had to do things to get breast milk and to be protected by adults. Later to survive, they had to get along with other people in a group context. They had to avoid predators, secure an ongoing supply of food, avoid toxins and diseases, and avoid getting killed by other people, to name just a few of their ongoing challenges. Then, in order to reproduce, they had to identify and attract desirable mates, fend off rivals who might pull their mates away, and then be sure that whatever offspring they might have had lived to reproductive age themselves. The individuals who dealt with these and many other adaptive problems most successfully passed along their genes, and those genes contained the instructions for new brains that could also solve such problems. So let's look at just a few examples, so that you'll start to get a sense of why certain emotional and behavioral tendencies are part of your own personality. Let's start with judgments of physical attractiveness. Of course, each of us finds certain people more attractive than other people, and each of us has certain personal preferences that other people might not agree with. But there are some notable consistencies in what people find attractive and unattractive that go deeper than just personal preference. Some people are simply more attractive or unattractive than other people are to just about everybody. So, for example, we don't usually find that people with really dark bags under their eyes are as attractive as exactly the same people without bags under their eyes. Or people with bloodshot eyes, they're not as attractive. More obviously, people who have facial deformities, their face is crooked or one eyelid droops, aren't as attractive. As I mentioned earlier, we also don't find people with open sores or obvious infections very attractive. And sometimes we're even viscerally repelled. These reactions are part of your personality. Whether you like feeling this way or not, and we sometimes feel badly about having these kinds of reactions, something is affecting our judgment of other people's appearance and making us less likely to want to interact with them. Most people show a clear and consistent preference for people without dark or bloodshot eyes or physical deformities or open sores. And that's true of people in every culture. But why? Because these are often signs of disease. It's not that everybody with these features is infectious or has something wrong with them, but sometimes these physical features do indicate some problem that we might catch. So natural selection favored individuals who kept their distance from people who showed signs of being sick. Or to look at it the other way, our prehistoric ancestors who found these features desirable and who sought out people who showed signs of being infected or having a disease, survived and reproduced at a lower rate than those who had negative reactions. So now it's part of everybody's personality. I said earlier that every normal person wants to be accepted and approved of by at least a few other people. People differ in the strength of this motive, but no one is as happy to be rejected as they are to be accepted. Again, we can trace the need for acceptance and belonging to natural selection. Today, most of us can survive without strong social connections. We can get our food at the store, go to the doctor when we're sick, count on our security system and the police to protect us, and hire people to do things that we need to have done. But for millions of years, we didn't have stores and doctors and police and hired hands to help us. Survival depended on being integrated into a supportive social group. How long would you last on the plains of Africa if you lived alone, armed only with a rock or a sharp stick? Natural selection favored individuals who were drawn to live with other people and who were motivated to behave in ways that led those other people to accept and support them. It was important to be concerned with how other members of the group viewed you and to avoid doing things that would get you kicked out. And that was a very adaptive strategy that increased the likelihood of survival and reproduction, not only for oneself, but also for one's offspring, because they were safer in the group as well. So a strong desire for acceptance and belonging evolved to be part of the human personality. Natural selection is also responsible for some of the differences that we see in the personalities of men and women. There's been a good deal of controversy over the years, both among scholars and among the general public, regarding whether differences that we see in the behavior of men and women are biological versus socialized. The pendulum has swung back and forth over the years, but there's not really any scientific doubt that differences between men and women have both biological and social sources. All other species of mammals show clear differences in the behaviors of males and females, so we would be a very unusual species if none of the sex differences that we see in human beings were evolved. But of course, socialization and culture and learning also play a big role in how men and women act. As we have seen, the fundamental principle underlying natural selection is that organisms that are the most successful at reproducing contribute disproportionately to the gene pool. So we are the descendants of prehistoric people who were most successful at reproducing. But throughout evolutionary history, men and women faced different reproductive challenges, and they have evolved different strategies to meet those challenges. Men and women face different reproductive challenges because they differ biologically in their reproductive roles. First, men and women differ in reproductive constraint. The simple fact that, over a lifetime, women can potentially have a much smaller number of children than men can. Even if she works really hard at it, no woman can have more than, say, 20 children at most. And of course, most women have far fewer. On the other hand, there's almost no limit to how many children a man could have if he really wanted to. You've probably heard that Genghis Khan sired several hundred children. Second, women invest much more into their offspring, biologically speaking, than men do, both during 9 months of pregnancy and if they're breastfeeding for many months afterwards. They need to take in more food. They're more limited in what they can do physically, and they're at greater safety risk. Again, we're talking about life on the African savanna here. Biologically, men invest a teaspoon of semen, and that's about it. So, women potentially have fewer opportunities to have children than men, and they invest more of their biological resources into each child they have. Now, let's think about the kinds of behaviors that natural selection would favor in order for women versus men to have a large number of healthy, genetically fit offspring. Because that's the currency with which evolution operates. Biologists tell us that if an organism has a limited number of opportunities to reproduce and must invest more into each offspring, then it should be more careful with each of its mating opportunities than an organism that has more potential opportunities to have offspring and little biological investment. With limited reproductive opportunities and greater investment, it can't afford to waste a reproductive opportunity on a bad choice. So it should be more selective in choosing mates. But an organism that can potentially have many offspring with a very low biological investment doesn't need to worry as much about any particular mating opportunities. Put differently, the greater one's reproductive constraint and biological investment, the more selective an animal should be. You can probably see where this is going. You don't need a biologist or a psychologist to tell you that women are more selective than men when it comes to sex, although there is plenty of research that documents this difference. This is a human universal. There is no society in which women are, as a group, less choosy and careful when it comes to sex than men are. It's part of the female personality to be more selective because throughout evolution, females who were more selective made better mating decisions and had a larger number of viable offspring who lived to reproductive age themselves. Of course, that doesn't say that there aren't highly promiscuous women and highly selective men. Other factors also affect people's sexual behavior. But on average, there's a big difference. Evolution may also play a role in what men and women find attractive. As I noted, we all have our personal preferences regarding who we find attractive. But we see some consistent differences between men and women that seem to be part of human nature. The most noticeable difference, and you can certainly see this in the people you know, is that on average, men prefer mates who are younger than they are. There are plenty of personal exceptions, of course. My wife is a couple of years older than I am. But this preference shows up in every one of 37 cultures in which mating preferences have been studied. You can see it starting in high school. Lots of senior guys dated sophomore and junior girls, but not many senior girls dated sophomore or junior guys, right? And if you look at the ages of heterosexual couples in the United States, women are, on average, 2.3 years younger than their male partner. No one doubts that all other things being equal, men prefer younger women. But why is that preference part of the male personality? Scientists believe that it comes down to another difference in the reproductive challenges that men and women faced during evolution. From the standpoint of natural selection, the central reproductive task is finding a fertile mate with good genes. Anybody who mated only with someone unable to have children didn't contribute to the gene pool. So natural selection should have favored people who chose fertile mates. But finding a fertile mate has been far less of a challenge for women than for men. After all, men are potentially fertile from puberty till death. Fertility certainly declines with age, but even 80-year-old men have fathered children. So almost no matter who women chose as a mate, chances are that he was fertile. But that wasn't the case for men, because women's reproductive years are limited. A woman might still have children with a 50 or 60-year-old man, but a man who preferred only 50 or 60-year-old women would not have passed along his genes. So natural selection would have favored men who preferred women who were younger than the age of menopause. Not only that, but a man was more likely to have more offspring the younger his mate was, because she had more childbearing years ahead of her. And this, too, would have given an evolutionary edge to men who preferred younger rather than older women. It would have been more advantageous for a 25-year-old man to have a 20-year-old mate than a 30-year-old mate, because she would have more reproductive years. So men today are mostly the descendants of males who preferred younger rather than older females as mates. Whatever it was about the brains of those prehistoric men that led them to prefer younger women is still in the brains of men today. Now, strictly speaking, it's a little misleading to say that men's brains are designed to prefer younger women. Technically, the important issue is fertility. Natural selection favored men who preferred fertile women. But the male brain evolved to use cues of fertility, such as physical indicators of youthfulness, to steer men's mating choices in certain directions. Something was passed along that made the brain interpret certain signs of relative youthfulness as more pleasing and attractive than signs of old age. This also explains why the older a man gets, the younger his age preference is relative to his own age. A 30-year-old man might prefer a 28-year-old woman, a 2-year difference. But if he had a choice, a 60-year-old man probably prefers someone younger than 58. Let me stress that none of this makes any sense in the modern world, in which people use contraception and often try to plan their families as best they can. In industrialized countries, most people who have children only have a couple. And most people, men and women alike, stop having kids by about age 40. But even though people today are virtually negating evolved dispositions to enhance reproduction, we're all walking around with a brain that evolved the way it did because it facilitated reproduction in prehistoric Africa hundreds of thousands of years ago. In the early days of evolutionary psychology, the focus was on the evolution of human nature, species-typical characteristics that can be seen more or less in every normal person. More recently, however, evolutionary psychologists have turned their attention to evolved processes that may contribute to differences among people. The general idea is that some evolved psychological adaptations may operate differently depending on different inputs from the individual's environment. If a single response is not adaptive under all circumstances, natural selection may create mechanisms that lead to different behaviors depending on environmental conditions. That means that people who live in one sort of environment may respond differently from the way that those who live in another environment respond. They would consistently differ from each other in terms of their typical reactions, but the source of the differences in their personalities would be an evolved conditional adaptation, one that appears only in certain environments. Let me give a couple of examples of what I mean by conditional adaptation. Throughout evolution, an adaptive problem that all children faced was to compete with their siblings for parental resources. Natural selection would have presumably favored children who were particularly successful at getting their share, if not more than their share, of food and protection and support and other resources from their parents. And if you have brothers or sisters, you know that siblings do seem to compete for their parents' attention. That seems to be more or less universal. But the best strategy for getting one's share may differ depending on whether the child is the firstborn, the secondborn, or the thirdborn child, or whatever. The firstborn child has an easy time of it, at least until the next brother or sister comes along. Then suddenly the firstborn has to share resources with a newcomer. One solution to this adaptive problem may be to identify with the parents and take on the responsibility of helping to raise the younger sibling. Firstborn children often assume such a helper role, and this leads them to develop more responsible personalities, to be higher in conscientiousness on average than later-born kids do. The second child in a family never has as much access to parents as the first one did, because big brother or sister was there from the start. And then when the third-born child comes along, he or she seems like an add-on. What's a later-born child to do? The youngest child, whatever number he or she is not going to have much authority or power in the family because everybody else is older. One solution to this problem is to get attention by being nonconforming and strong-willed, and maybe even a little bit rebellious. Being responsible like older brother or sister isn't going to help that much. Evolutionary psychologists talk about this sort of process as strategic niche specialization. Although all kids have faced the same general adaptive problem, how to get what they need in the context of the family, they may differ in how they pursue that goal depending on the environment that they're born into based on their birth order. They essentially specialize in filling different niches within the family. And that difference in strategic niche specialization shows up as a difference in their personalities. Psychologists have been interested for many years in the effects of growing up in dangerous and stressful environments on personality development. No one questions that personality is affected when people grow up under very stressful conditions, whether that's a conflict-ridden family with constant fighting between the parents, or being physically abused, or growing up in a war zone. The question is, why does stress affect personality as it does? An evolutionary spin on this question is that the most effective strategies for dealing with common adaptive problems may differ depending on the stressfulness of the situation. If so, natural selection may have developed conditional adaptive strategies that are sensitive to the stressors in the environment. When the environment is relatively calm and stress-free, one set of strategies emerge. But when all hell's breaking loose, another set arises. One provocative example involves the effects of childhood stress on the onset of puberty in girls. Central to this theory is the idea that human beings can potentially achieve reproductive success in one of two ways. When the environment is safe and predictable, the best strategy might have been to have fewer kids and then invest more effort and resources in each one of them. But when the environment is dangerous and uncertain, the best strategy might be to pursue a faster quantity over quality reproductive strategy. Under dangerous conditions, it's less certain that an individual can find a partner with whom to reproduce, and any offspring will be at greater risk as well. Interestingly, girls who grow up under more stressful conditions tend to start puberty earlier. They actually reach biological menarche, the start of menstruation, at an earlier age. and they also tend to become sexually active and start having children earlier. From an evolutionary perspective, this reflects an evolved conditional adaptation. For our purposes, it manifests as a difference in personality. Let me stress that this explanation about the effect of stressful conditions is both speculative and controversial, but it does have a certain amount of research support. So I mention it not as a confirmed fact, but rather to show you the direction in which evolutionary analyses of personality and behavior are headed. Let me wrap up by summarizing the three big take-home messages from this lecture. Number one, some aspects of your personality reflect evolved tendencies that you share with virtually everybody else. Because some ways of behaving were critical to survival and reproduction for millions of years, they became part of the shared human personality. Number two, other features of your personality evolve specifically for your sex. From the beginning, men and women have faced somewhat different reproductive problems based mostly on the fact that they played different biological roles in reproduction. So some sex differences in personality seem to reflect these sex-specific adaptations. And number three, evolutionary processes may also be responsible for certain differences among people. Because some evolved adaptations are conditional on the environment, people who live in different environments may develop different personalities.